Danville Overhead Doors for its support of Focus 580. Overhead Doors is pleased to support public radio in Central Illinois on behalf of its customers and business associates. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back David Sineau. He is clinical professor of finance at the University of Illinois in the College of Business. And once a month, for quite a long time now, he's been stopping by, as always on Friday, to talk a little bit about personal finance and money management. And he begins by making a few comments and sometimes has something to say about the economy generally, or it may be some more specific kind of financial planning topic he'd like to talk with you a little bit about. And then, if you have questions on that or anything else that has to do with investing, financial planning, money management, I know that Dave would do his best to help you out. So with that, we say good morning. Welcome back. Glad to have you here again.
Well, good morning, David. And as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. I'd like to take a few minutes this morning and discuss two different but related topics. First, an update on the stock market. And second, a brief overview of perhaps the most important regulatory legislation of the past 50 years, that being the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation. Well, as many of us know, the stock market has enjoyed a solid upward move in the past 6 weeks, and particularly since the presidential election. For example, as of yesterday's close for the year, the S&P 500 index was up more than 6%. The Russell 2000, some of those smaller companies, was up approximately 12%, and even the NASDAQ has made a nice little return, up being almost 5%. Additionally, small cap value sectors were up approximately 11%, and the large cap value sector as well was up almost 10%. Now, these gains are especially impressive in light of some other tough economic news. Oil prices that have really gyrated around $50 a barrel or higher. Substantial increases in basic foodstuffs, metals, consumer inflation. In fact, a report came out earlier this week or late last week that the CPI actually increased some 0.6% during the month of October. We've had 4 increases in interest rates orchestrated by the Federal Reserve. The target Fed funds rate, which not too long ago was at 1%, is now targeted at 2%. We all know about a worsening federal deficit and a record balance of payments deficit in the neighborhood of some $50 billion per month, a lot of that caused by the excessively high price of oil per barrel. And, of course, we just heard a record low dollar abroad as compared to the euro. And, David, I know all about that one. I have a daughter studying abroad this semester, and I think the battle cry is, Dad, send euros, because that American dollar doesn't seem to go very far. Yet in spite of this seemingly negative news, the stock market is showing an amazing resilience. First, it's instructive to remember that the stock market prices are really reflective of the future, some 6 to 12 months out. And Wall Street clearly believes that companies will report stronger profits and hence stronger earnings per share, which is the ultimate driver of the price of a stock. We've got to have earnings per share. Now, in my view, there are really 3 major drivers for the current stock market rally. First, our economy is seemingly out of recession and job growth is indeed picking up. 2, the likelihood of major increased taxes, both at the personal and the corporate level, are unlikely, at least when we're talking about federal income tax and federal corporate taxation, because we have the Republican majority in a seat of power. And 3, because our dollar is so cheap against the euro, American companies are shipping their goods abroad at a record pace. In other words, our exports are inexpensive, fueling record foreign purchases and substantial profits for American companies. For example, Caterpillar recently reported that it has record orders for heavy machinery to be shipped abroad, unlike anything they've ever seen in the history of their company. The other important stock market lesson is you just really can't afford to time the market. Basically, If you have had your investable cash on the sidelines really over the past 60 days, and more particularly over the past 3 weeks, you have missed most of the stock market gains for this year. Rather, for most individuals, it is the best strategy, of course, to allocate your dollar between the stock and fixed income sectors of the market, diversify among these sectors, among the various asset classes, and sit. Don't trade. I've talked about this so many times. We've got to have exposure to big companies, small companies, value companies, etc. And of course, one of the easiest ways to diversify is through the use of indexes and or tracking stocks. So it's very, very tough to try to time the market and be on the sidelines and watch this amazing, very, very rapid, quick move upward and miss it. Finally, I'd like to spend a few moments discussing, unquestionably in my view, the most important business ethics legislation enacted in the past 50 years. It is entitled Sarbanes-Oxley. Now, this legislation really was a reaction to the business scandals of Enron, WorldCom, etc., where shareholders, employees, and even the public were literally lied to by senior executives from these companies, and the financial statements tendered by these companies were intentionally misrepresented. We all know the results. Billions of dollars of loss suffered by employees from these companies, shareholders from these companies, creditors of these companies, and vendors of these companies. And certainly, equally as important, and perhaps even more important, a loss of confidence by the investing public in the integrity of the financial reporting and the integrity of the way of doing business of publicly traded companies. In its simplest form, Sarbanes-Oxley requires the CEO, as well as the CFO — now the CFO is the chief financial officer — the CFO and CEO of publicly traded companies to sign off on their financial statements and attest that they are true and correct. Further, if at a later time these statements are shown to be materially in error, the officers of these companies can actually do some jail time. As a result, literally millions, if not billions of dollars, are being spent by publicly traded companies to ensure they are adopting the best practices available for financial reporting purposes. This has spurred a whole new industry of consultants. It has made billions, if not more, dollars worth of business for financial companies, for CPA companies. If you do a Google search and you simply type in Sarbanes-Oxley, you will find thousands and thousands of sites, thousands and thousands of articles, thousands and thousands of hits. So this is a whole new era called Sarbanes-Oxley for corporate America. So as a result, simultaneously, even boards of public companies are becoming far more proactive, more independent, assuming a far larger role in corporate governance issues. Even banks and insurance companies are demanding that their own customers comply with Sarbanes legislation as a condition precedent to obtaining credit or renewing lines of credit or obtaining insurance, for example. There is no doubt in my mind that Sarbanes-Oxley is changing the face and the way companies do business. The net result has been positive for the investing public because there is a stronger likelihood that the investing public can now rely on the reported operating results of a company and thereby make far more intelligent investment decisions. And finally, I wanted to take this opportunity to wish the wonderful listening audience and supporters of WILL a very joyous Thanksgiving holiday. And of course, David, as always, I'll be delighted to tackle the questions from our listeners.
All right. We have a couple people here ready to go. Let me just again very quickly introduce the guest. If you don't know this guy, his name is David Sinnoh. He's a clinical professor of finance at the U of I and the College of Business. And once a month, almost on Friday in the 10 o'clock hour, he's here. And we invite your questions on personal finance, money management. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call, 333 9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and we will pay for the call if you want to use that. That's 800-222-9455. We have two people here ready to go, starting out with someone listening this morning in Piatt County on our toll-free line, line four, right here.
Good morning.
Hello, yes.
Good morning.
First of all, I want to thank you for all of your excellent advice, and then now I'm ready to ask you for some more. I perfectly agree with your intro about investable cash and being willing to sit and watch it. Only, how does one do that? I am such a novice. And if you go to the Vanguard site or Fidelity site or TIAA CREF site, there are so many funds, and I'm just so hesitant to, how do you pick a fund? And what I would like, of course, they have questionnaires for you about your degree of risk and your long-term, medium-term, or short-term goals. And my goals are just savings. I just would like to put, you know, my investable cash away in savings and without a great deal of risk. So how does one pick a fund out of the, are there, I believe there are thousands, right?
Well, that's right. There are literally over 14,000,
okay,
as it turns out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very, very difficult.
Yes.
And are you suggesting that you would like to take some of your cash that is probably earning 1% or,
yes,
less, take a bit more risk with it,
yes,
earn a higher rate of interest, but have preservation of principal?
Yes.
All right. So that tells me you're not going to be in the stock market with that sum of money, because in any short period of time, unless, as I refer to, you're being a legacy investor,
mm-hmm,
with a very long-term outlook, stocks can head south pretty drastically, mm-hmm, pretty quickly. People then get scared and they move out of that market and have a very bitter experience.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result, I'm going to suggest to you that a strategy with some of your investable cash for preservation of capital and earning a bit higher interest than current savings account interest that is available.
Mm-hmm.
And this probably involves doing some sleuthing,
mm-hmm,
and doing some searching. And this, you might be a person who could take advantage of what I would refer to as a laddering strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that you break your money up into four equal piles.
Okay.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you invest 1/4 of your money for, let's say, 6 months,
okay,
1/4 of your money for 12 months, 1/4 for 18, and 1/4 for 24 months.
Mm-hmm.
And you might do something as simple as purchasing certificates of deposit.
Okay.
Typically, institutions will allow you to purchase certificates of deposit with a minimum of $2,500. So let's just assume that your nest egg is $10,000,
mm-hmm,
just for the sake of that.
Mm-hmm.
You might go out and shop a 6-month CD, a 12-month, an 18-month, and a 24-month CD. Presumably, the longer out that you're willing to tie up your money, for example, 24 months as opposed to 6,
mm-hmm,
then the higher interest rate that you will be earning. And I have noticed lately in Champaign County a number of banks advertising reasonably high 2-year interest rates,
mm-hmm,
in excess of 3%, for example. Right now, that doesn't seem like a lot at the present time. But recall and remember that if you invest your money in a 6-month increment, when that 6-month CD comes due, you simply take that money and you roll it out to a 24-month instrument. So you always have a 6, 12, 18, and 24-month instrument.
Mm-hmm.
So you are always averaging, if you will, what interest rates are doing in the economy.
Okay.
And typically, banks are paying higher interest rates than Treasury instruments. And it's a cheaper way to invest,
okay,
because you can do it yourself. You don't have commissions. And it really just takes a little willpower and telephone power,
right,
to search out those rates. And remember that certificates of deposit, of course, are FDIC insured, which means they're really government backed, up to the tune of $100,000. So until you have more than $100,000 in one institution, specifically just titled in your name,
mm-hmm,
you're pretty well backed by the full faith and credit of the government on those certificates of deposit. So that certainly is one choice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, along with that, if you're willing to, say, take 50-60% of your money, you might consider, in addition, buying a couple of fixed income funds.
Okay.
And I would be looking at short-term fixed income funds, and I specifically like funds that have an average maturity of 2 to 3 years.
Okay.
So I'm more concerned about the maturity or something called the duration of the fund, which is a little bit different than maturity. It's how fast you get your money back, really. In the 2 to 3 year range, I think that's a good bang for your buck currently. Mm-hmm. And you could look at short-term, you mentioned Fidelity funds, mm-hmm. Vanguard funds. And I think if you stay in high-quality short-term funds with a portion of your money, you may do just a little bit better than even the certificates of deposit. But it would be a nice blend, uh-huh. if you will. So I think those are choices that you should investigate if you are really interested in preservation of principal.
Okay. Well, this has been a big help. Thank you so much.
All right. My pleasure.
Well, thanks for the call. Let's go next to another caller listening up in Sycamore, Illinois, on our line number one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in your thoughts on investing in IRAs. It occurs to me that since stocks get favorable tax treatment, both in their earnings dividends right now and also, of course, capital gains, that they're not really a very good idea for putting into an IRA, because when you draw that IRA money out at the when you reach age 59 and a half, that now correct me on this. I understand that when you start drawing money out of an IRA, it's taxed at normal rates.
You're absolutely right. Now, that is if you are in a traditional IRA program, and that is that where you took a deduction going into the program.
Right.
If you took a deduction going in, then all of the money that you put in plus all of the earnings, it's growing tax deferred. You're in a tax deferred environment, but the moment that you start taking it out, typically after age 59 and a half, because there are no special penalties after age 59 and a half, it's all treated as ordinary income, just like other retirement income, if you will. And it is truly taxed at your highest marginal tax rate because you're layering those dollars on top of whatever other income that you have. Now, that, of course, is in contradistinction to a Roth IRA. Uh-huh. And many people are eligible for a Roth IRA because typically if you're single, you got to be earning well into the 90s not to be eligible. And if you are married, you've got to be earning well into the 150s. Or 160s not to be eligible. So most people in America are eligible to establish a Roth IRA. And of course, that is established with after-tax dollars. You've already paid tax on those dollars. You have a job, you go to work, you pay tax, you've got some excess cash flow afterwards, and you can establish a Roth IRA. And of course, that's what I typically recommend to my students, to my friends, because the truth of the matter is that that grows in a tax-free environment. And again, if you wait until retirement, take the money out when we're old and gray, then all of the money coming out of a Roth IRA escapes taxation. And in addition, there is no requirement that you ever take your money out of a Roth IRA. Whereas in a traditional IRA, once one hits 70 and a half, or really April 1 following the year in which you reach 70 and a half, you must start taking minimum distributions out, which might be taxed at 35%, for example, currently, which is the highest marginal federal income tax rate. With the Roth, one, you don't have to take it out. Two, if you do take it out, no tax. No federal income tax, no state income tax, no nothing tax. So that's a great program if you are eligible to participate in that. So that would be my first choice, would be the Roth IRA. Now, you've brought up another very interesting question, and that is, look, if I have a gain on a stock, I now get favorable capital gains rates of 15%. If that stock pays a dividend, I get a favorable tax rate on my dividends. Wouldn't it be more sensible to invest in the stock market, throwing off dividends in my after-tax funds, and maybe my IRA funds, my traditional IRA funds, should be in fixed income? I think that's what you're really asking.
That's right.
And that makes a good deal of sense, so long as you have an overall allocation that you feel comfortable with.
Okay, yeah.
All right? Mm-hmm. If you have a 50 or 60-40 allocation and your 60% is outside of your IRAs, well, then okay, I don't have a problem with that 40% being in fixed income inside your IRAs.
Right. That's exactly what we're doing right now. But I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't losing an opportunity here somehow.
No, I think the bigger issue is keep track of what is my allocation. And if I can do my stocks outside and feel comfortable and eventually reap a capital gain and I'm a long-term legacy investor, by all means, that makes perfect sense.
Very good. Thanks very much.
All great right. question.
Bye now.
Next is a caller in line number two, and this listener is in Champaign. Hello.
Yeah. Now, I heard you talking about the stock market being optimistic for the next 12 months, and I think of 12 months as near term. But given the lack of fiscal discipline on the part of the Bush administration and the likelihood that deficits and debt are going to continue to go up dramatically, and if one believes that we're in for a significant round of inflation over the next several years, and given the obligations in terms of military spending, the war on terror, and all that, likelihood of that continuing, and even the possibility of going into 70s-style stagflation, what would be investment strategy for retirement, someone with a 15-year time horizon, would you suggest?
Well, those are great observations and great questions. First, let me say that Wall Street is predicting good things because they have run up. I didn't say that I was necessarily predicting good things because I simply don't know. It may well turn out that we have increasing staggering debts, increasing staggering balance of payments problems. We may have inflation. We may have stagflation. All of the things that you mentioned are indeed possibilities, but I'm not in the prediction business. So therefore, I'm in the long-term investment business because we've seen all of these kinds of elements throughout our stock market and fixed income investing history, and we seem to have survived. But unquestionably, they can cause dramatic pain in a short period of time. Now, you're telling me that your time horizon is 15 years. Is that correct?
Yeah, thereabouts.
Okay. And in 15 years, are you telling me you're going to be at retirement age?
Yes.
Okay. Now, here is the biggest mistake I think people make when thinking about their retirement and their portfolio. And that is that while they are going to retire in 15 years, assuming reasonably good health, assuming a reasonably good case history in the family of good health, most people can plan to live at least 20 years beyond that target retirement age. And the biggest mistake that people make as they move toward retirement, in fact, there was a great analysis of this recently on the Vanguard website and through the Vanguard newsletter, is that they suddenly become too conservative and they suddenly move completely out of equities and into fixed income. So my feeling is that you've got to look at this not as a 15-year period of time, but perhaps a 30 to 35-year period of time. And while you may become more conservative in terms of your allocation between stocks and fixed income, I nevertheless feel that it's important with that type of 30-year time horizon that a minimum and a bare-bones minimum of 40% of your assets are in very, very diversified equity positions. And then 60% of your portfolio can be, shall we say, allocated toward fixed income choices. So I want to be real careful that we're not talking just about a 15-year period of time and suddenly we're there. We're talking really over a longer period of time. So we have to be thinking about total return. What is our total return picture going to look like as opposed to how much fixed income can we generate in year 15 off of our portfolio? So I want you to think about it and concentrate on that asset allocation because total return really becomes very important. Now, having said that, over any 15-year period of time, clearly stocks could well underperform fixed income investments. There's no question about that. But typically, even in that 15-year period of time, there will be asset classes that outperform the market in general. So diversification becomes so extraordinarily important, especially having allocations in value components. So typically what happens is when stock markets head south, you want to be in those value components of the market. Small cap value, even mid cap value, and to some extent larger cap value, because they seem to hold up best in any short period of time. So again, you've got to go back and examine that portfolio. But I wouldn't fall below a 40% equity / 60% fixed income long-term perspective, even with its only 15 years to retirement.
What do you think in terms of the bond portion of an allocation? Right now, what I have bonds in is the Vanguard Total Index Fund, as opposed to, say, more intermediate or short term.
Well, the Vanguard Total Bond Index has held up very well in spite of the fact that it has a bit longer maturity. I'd be a little concerned to have all my apples in the Vanguard Long-Term Bond Index. It's a great total bond index. It's a great fund. And it's certainly a flagship fund. And for all of your fixed income, to have 25% of it in that area doesn't bother me. But beyond 25%, especially where we see a interest rate environment that is likely to go up, if you truly believe in your own predictions of further deficits, further balance of payments issues, further currency issues, further inflation issues, that means that interest rates are heading higher. And I guess if someone held a gun to my head, yes, I would say they're probably heading higher. I just don't know when. So I think the total bond market index with 25% of your fixed income makes sense. I would have it at least 25% additional in shorter term positions, and maybe you're a good candidate to ladder, maybe over a 3-year period, having a 1, 2, and 3-year fixed income instrument in a ladder so you can roll as interest rates move up.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we're at our midpoint, a little bit past the midpoint here. Our guest is David Sinnoh, clinical professor of finance at the U of I College of Business. Once a month on a Friday, he's here. We talk about personal finance issues. Your questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next, we'll go to LaSalle on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm. Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call. I hope you can help me because I've had it explained to me, but I have 144 shares of AT&T Wireless, which in my proxy I voted against singular merging. But I got my statement, and they informed me on my statement that they had sold my shares. And, of course, I've never bought or sold any shares. I just leave them ride. And I wonder, how can they do that without me saying I want to sell them?
Well, I'm not quite clear. Are you saying that you received a proxy to vote about the merger?
Well, I'm talking way back in April when they had their meeting, et cetera, but that's beside the point. I just shouldn't have even mentioned that. But what I don't understand is, excuse me, because they merged with Singular, how did they have the right to sell my stocks?
Well, because a merger or acquisition is voted upon by all of the shareholders.
Yeah.
And you, my dear, were in the minority of those shareholders.
Okay.
Now, sometimes in these acquisition or merger agreements, there is a differing percentage of shareholders that are required to approve a merger document.
Uh-huh.
Typically in the 70% range.
Okay.
So I would have to go back and actually look at the merger documents, but you clearly voted in the minority.
Okay.
So this is a case where majority rules,
okay,
and you now have Singular,
right,
as opposed to AT&T.
Excuse me, I don't see anything that says Singular.
Well,
it just said they're giving me cash.
Oh, so
they're
you have the right,
cash.
You actually have cash.
They're
so you're being bought out.
Cash, whether,
yep,
whether I wanted or not, and I was upset because in 96 I had 450 shares of AT&T, and through reverse splits, et cetera, I've now got 90 shares of AT&T and then this 144 of wireless. So, in other words, they do have the right. With other mergers I've had with other stocks, they would allow us, give us spinoffs of that stock or
yes,
something.
Yes, but that isn't necessarily required in the merger document. So that's really what occurred, is you were bought out for cash.
I guess.
So I know you're unhappy.
I am, because capital gains and all that baloney I've got to pay, and I wanted to keep that stock. It was good.
Yeah, and on top of that, it's even difficult to figure out what your basis is.
That's the problem.
That is the problem. So did you buy this through a broker?
No. In fact, I inherited it, and when I inherited it, I don't know if I have to go back to for my income tax to when the price was, you know, because they have merged and they've got wireless. At that time, as I said, I had 450 shares of AT&T, which were worth about $16,000-$20,000 for those shares. And now with this piddling, $2,160 for these shares. And I mean, you've lost some
ground.
I guess.
Yep. And believe me, AT&T used to be the stock for orphans and widows.
Exactly.
And it really has disappointed, as most public utilities have disappointed over the last 15 to 20 years.
Okay.
Now, in order to figure out your basis, you're going to have to go back to that federal estate tax return.
Mm-hmm.
All right, if you can get your hands on it. And then you will be able to do some sleuthing and figure out per share what your original basis was in that stock.
Well, I have all my statements, excuse me, and I've looked up, you know, what they were worth at the time. But with these wireless, I mean, going into different companies, buying Comcast, et cetera, I mean,
you take your original basis from that estate tax return.
Okay.
All right, because it will show on an estate tax return. Okay. Subtract from that all of your other gains. And all of your other distributions.
Oh, boy.
From that. And that will then give you your effective basis in what is remaining and then what you got for it, and you may well have a long-term capital loss. If you have a long-term capital loss, you can offset $3,000 of that against ordinary income.
Oh.
All right? So you may be able to take some of that capital loss and get a tax break on it if indeed that's the way it turns out.
Now, when you say distributions, you mean every month I have to go through statements and see how much they lost or they...
No. Just exactly. In other words, how many dollars did you take out of these positions? Subtract that from your estate tax return basis. That will give you your current basis in AT&T.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, that's probably the easy way to do it. May not be 100% accurate, but pretty darn close.
Okay.
And I don't think you're going to get audited by some IRS agent over that.
I hope not.
No, I don't think so.
I'm 78 years old, and I want to just relax.
Feed them cookies. Give them a glass of milk. They'll be happy.
You are a sweetheart.
All right. You take care.
Thanks for the call. We'll come back here local to Urbana, the next caller, line number one. Hello.
Yes. I had always thought that I wanted about a 50-50 mix for my retirement portfolio, but I recently took an early retirement, which I hadn't really planned on doing, but now I have a lifetime pension that will cover most of our living expenses, and I was wondering if I should think differently about my asset allocation. Should I treat my pension like a bond?
Yes. No, unquestionably, your pension should be treated as a fixed income investment. Is your pension indexed for inflation?
Yes. It goes up 3% a year.
All right. So that's even more important because that gives you some flexibility with your other investments to increase your stock market allocation. Because of the indexing for inflation. Just like Social Security supposedly goes up for cost of living each year, you're indexed to some index in your pension. And that's a good thing because lots and lots of pensions are not indexed and they always stay at the same number.
Right.
So this does afford you the opportunity to rethink. Now, what you would need to do is you would need to have some financial savvy, perhaps you have that, where you could actually determine the present value of this future stream of pension benefits. And is it a joint and survivor annuity, which means that if you pass away, your spouse would receive 50%?
Yes.
Okay. So there are any number of people who you could probably even look this up yourself and work backwards and figure out what that present value is today. Is it $500,000? Is it $800,000? Is it $1 million? Based upon your joint life expectancies.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Once you determine that, then you've got a hard number, and maybe that number is $700,000. Then you can look at your other assets and say, well, gee, if this is fixed income, do I have $700,000 in equities, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You see where I'm going?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So that's what you need to do is you need to determine first the present value dollar of that future stream of benefits in your pension fund, and it can be done, and then look at that number and compare that to your equity position.
I have a printout of what it is to age 80. Is that the figure you're talking about?
Well, is that a large number? Not
yeah.
not just the stream of income. Have they discounted that back to a present value?
It's the cumulative value over, you know, the next 20 years or so.
Okay, but I don't think that cumulative value has been discounted back to its present value.
Okay.
So you'd have to take each year of that stream of earnings and use a discounting factor, probably in the area of 4 to 5%, and discount each of those numbers back to today.
Uh-huh.
So the 20-year number would be discounted back 20 years. The 19th-year cumulative number would be discounted back 19 years. You would add up all of those. It can be done on a calculator, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives you a present value number, which says, gee, how much money do I need to have today, based at this interest rate, to ensure this future stream of earnings based upon our joint lives?
Mm-hmm.
Once you've got that number, then you've got a number that you can compare to your equity position.
Okay.
All right?
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks for the good program.
Well, congratulations on retiring early.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks a lot. Let's go to Eureka, line 3. This is the next caller. Hello.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, we have most of our investments in CDs, that we've got some money in a money market. And I was wondering, would it be better to put that like in a 5-year CD at 4.15 or in I-bonds?
Well, I'm not very excited about tying your money up in a 5-year CD at 4.15, even though that's an excellent, excellent rate, unless it is part of an overall strategy and, for example, a CD ladder. So if you had a 1-year CD, a 2-year, a 3-year, a 4-year, and 5-year, and you wanted to go out on the bond ladder 5 years, so your average maturity is really only 2.5 years, because we could divide the 5 by half, and you'd have an average maturity of 2.5 years, then as part of an overall strategy, I don't have a problem with that. I don't certainly have a problem with the rate. As far as the I-bonds, I think right now, you probably could do a little bit better in a CD ladder. So that would be my advice. But it's simply just buying one CD going out 5 years. I'm not in favor of that unless it's part of an overall bond strategy.
Yeah, we do have some different maturities. But then what I thought is, say, in 2 years, if the rates would go up, you know, quite a bit, why a person could pay the penalty and draw that out?
Well, they could. They could. But again, if you're in a laddered situation, and where you have laddered maturities, maybe they are maturing every 6 months, then you're in a position to grow with interest rates if interest rates move up.
No,
so I'm really not very excited about your causing yourself penalties, because it's unnecessary if you set the bond ladder up correctly to begin with.
Now, on the I-bonds, if interest rates would go up, that would go up too. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you think that would probably be just as good?
Well, I'm saying that right now, I think there's a slight competitive advantage in a certificate of deposit mm-hmm. bond ladder. You could hedge your bets and do both.
Okay, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Right, very good. And on we go to Attica, Indiana here, line number 2.
Yes,
hello.
I have a question. I'm 65 and have a traditional IRA and will need to be taking some of that out before too awful long. And I don't really expect to be needing that. I might as well just have my stocks in an IRA is someplace else. And I was wondering, with the current tax law, which has lower capital gains taxes and lower rates on dividends, if it would be a good idea for me to pay those taxes on that now and convert it to a Roth IRA?
Well, it's an interesting question. A lot of that depends upon your tax bracket. A lot of it depends upon your tax bracket. And remember that if you are thinking of converting from a traditional to a Roth, you don't have to do it all at once. You don't have to take the entire traditional IRA, convert it to a Roth, and then pay income tax at that highest rate. Now, do you find yourself, I know you're 65 years young, are you filing married or single?
Single.
So you're filing single. So very clearly, the moment that you have in excess of $30,000 of taxable income, you're in a 25% federal income tax bracket.
Yeah, and I'm probably higher than that.
Okay, and between $70,000 and about $147,000, you find yourself in a 28%. So, and if you're higher than that, then you're one of these people in America who's paying at least at 33% federally. I frankly would have a problem, I think, if you find yourself jumping into those higher rates of converting to a Roth IRA. Remember that you're not required to take this money out until you are 70 and a half. And at 70 and a half, you name a beneficiary. I presume you have some beneficiaries named on your IRA. Do you have children or someone named as beneficiary?
I'm sure I have somebody named, but I set it up so long ago, I don't know who it is.
Okay, well, one thing you ought to do is recheck your beneficiary of your IRA. And if that beneficiary is younger than you are, then the odds are that you really don't have to take very much money out of that IRA, even at 70 and a half.
Oh,
probably about one. Well, for a single taxpayer who maybe has a beneficiary 5 to 10 years younger, it would probably be about 1/22nd the first year, about 4.5%. So it's not like you have to take all your money out at one time. Maybe the first year 4%, the next year 5%, the next year 6%, 7%, 8%. So I'm not sure that that would be such a burden that it would cause you to roll your money to a Roth IRA. I think it's a good issue for your tax accountant to look at. So he or she could go over that with you and look at the ramifications of rolling into a Roth IRA. So I think it's really a tax-driven question. I don't think it's a question of whether you'd get capital gains treatment and you'd be better off in a Roth. I think you've got to look at your marginal rate, sit down with your accountant, see if it makes sense. But keep in mind, at 70 and a half, you don't suddenly have to take 10 or 20 or 50 or $100,000 out of your Roth IRA. It's a very small fraction in the early years that you must access through your IRA.
I see. I was kind of thinking that the tax rates are going to be a lot higher in 5 or 10 years than they are now, and that maybe it would be better to pay the taxes on now rather than later.
I think you can reserve that decision. I don't see personal income tax rates dramatically increasing, at least over the next 4 years. I just don't see that occurring.
I don't see in four, but let's say in the next presidential election.
Okay, well, we're speculating.
Right.
So you have plenty of time between now and then to make these kinds of decisions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much. Very
My good. Pleasure.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is David Sinnoh. He is clinical professor of finance at U of I in the College of Business, and monthly is here on a Friday. We talk about money management. We have time for some other callers and a couple of people here ready to go. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Caller up next is in Aurora, line 4. Hello.
Yes, I'm in the same circumstances as that woman with the AT&T stock. Would you suggest buying Singular now?
You know, for people who follow me on this program, including yourself, I'm not an individual stock buyer.
Oh.
I don't follow Singular. I have no opinion about Singular. It may be the greatest thing since duck soup. People ask me 100 times what I thought about Google. Again, when I watched it go from 120 to 190, I still have no opinion about Google. I'm just not an individual stock market investor, so I'm the wrong person to ask with reference to that, because it just is. I'm just not smart enough to figure that stuff out, to be honest about it.
So you could
be right or wrong, and if you were going to buy Singular and you thought it was a good buy, then sometimes it's better to be half right or half wrong, so buy half of what you were intending to buy. That would be my advice.
Thank you so much.
Right,
bye-bye.
Thanks. And this goes back, obviously, again, if people have been listening to you for a long enough time, this goes back to your feeling that, A, yes, it is good to be invested in stocks, but, B, you never know how stocks are going to do. So the thing you want to do is you want to spread out your risk. And as you have said so many times, you want to be broadly invested in the market. And that's why, and for most people, the way to do that is going to be with mutual funds. And you can do that with mutual funds that buy either large slices of the market, or there are some that just buy big companies, some that buy middle companies, some that buy smaller companies. And if you do that, if you pick, you know, maybe 3-4 different kinds of funds, you can actually cover the market broadly enough so that if one or two or even a whole sector of stocks don't do well, you're not going to be in the tank because you've put everything into those.
That's absolutely right, David. And in the academic world, it's referred to as systematic and unsystematic risk. Systematic risk simply means, hey, for stepping up to the batter's box and buying the stock market, there's some risk. There simply is some risk. But at least you don't have something called unsystematic risk, which is where I choose one company and I may think it's the greatest thing since duck soup, and I wake up the next day and it's blown up in my face. Single stocks, I have systematic risk. Single industries, I have systematic risk. And one can diversify out of systematic risk by owning large baskets of positions or enough stocks for people who know what they're doing. And two, we can't diversify out of just the risk of the market, but certainly, again, we can diversify out of this something called unsystematic risk.
Okay. To Urbana, line one. This is the next person here. Hello.
Yes, a caller a few minutes ago raised a couple of tax questions, which reminds me it would be great if a future show could, Mr. Sinnoh could bring in a local income tax expert who could perhaps update us on recent tax law changes and who could answer our questions as we're trying to plan our finances in line of current and recent tax changes. One other comment, so think about that if you could.
That's a great idea.
The lady who called several minutes ago about AT&T had two choices, actually. Number one, she could, I guess, accept the fact that AT&T was sold out, and I suppose she could keep her stock certificates and shred them, or she could accept the $15 cash per share. Since AT&T Wireless doesn't exist anymore, she didn't have a third choice, unfortunately. So, and I'm assuming most people would say, rather than shred my certificates, I'll take the $15 cash per share. It could be worse.
Well, that's absolutely right. And you know what's really interesting? People who had Enron stock and WorldCom stock, maybe 100 shares, 50 shares, and held on to it to the bitter end, of course, these have become collector's items now.
And that's all they're good for.
And you see them at flea markets, and they are selling for phenomenal amounts of money.
Oh.
So I don't know. Do you have some of those old stocks? But I know you're a savvy investor, so you probably
didn't get
burned like that.
I happily took my $15 cash from AT&T and moved on.
Well, good.
Thank you very much for listening to my suggestion
right.
about a tax guest.
Very good.
We'll be listening next time.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go here. We have somebody on cell phone next, line two. Hello.
Yes, can you tell me, are taxes on 401Ks and 403Bs handled the same as traditional IRA?
Yes, that's the bottom line, 59.5, 70.5. The difference with a 403B or a 401K is typically you don't access that while you are still working, But if you're retired, they have the same rules, although for some 403B programs, even though the minimum distributions are required to start at 70.5, there are exceptions where you can put off minimum distributions until 75, so long as you are still employed. So those are a couple of the differences. But basically, from an income tax perspective, when you're pulling money out of 401Ks and 403Bs, that money that went in was tax-deferred money. You got a break going in. The gains were tax deferred. You've got to pay the piper when you're coming out with funds out of those positions. And it's taxed at ordinary income tax rates, whatever those rates are, on the date that you take the money out.
Okay. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Let's go to Charleston, line number three. Hello.
Hello. Quick question. in determining your allocation, or excuse me, your asset allocation, what role, if any, would you say it was played by having the equity in your house? In my case, I own my house outright, and should that be brought into the equation somehow or not at all?
Only in the sense that if you were seriously looking at real estate investment trusts or funds, which basically invested in real estate investment trusts, as a asset class, then I would probably reduce my exposure in that particular asset class. So that I said, look, I have a substantial position already in real estate. I think I have enough in that particular area. So as a result, I don't want to be heavily invested in the market that's in the business of owning and managing real estate. So otherwise, though, I don't think it has a lot to do with anything for a couple of reasons. One is that even if you have a lot of equity in your house, it's really not going anywhere. You're probably not going to access it unless you need the money. And you've always got to have a roof over your house. So it's not like you can just take that money and enjoy it or spend it or watch it even grow further. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Well, we're just about the point we've got to finish here. We maybe have a minute or so. Any last little thing you'd like to leave with folks this time around?
Well, in 2005, we spent a lot of time talking about IRAs. Remember that the maximum IRA contribution in 2005 for people basically under the age of 50 is $4,000, and then there are some catch-up provisions, so people over the age of 50, it's $4,500. So that's a substantial amount of money that one could posit into a Roth IRA, for example, and that would be a good use of money. So don't neglect, even if you haven't done your 2004 allocation to an IRA, you could do both your 2004 and come January of 2005, start pushing money in for 2005.
We'll try to do one more here. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. In considering asset classes, do you generally advise married people to consider their the money owned by each of them, including a pension as a fixed income? And so on?
Yes. You've got to look at your totality of circumstances, and pension income has to be thought of as a fixed income asset.
Okay. Even if it's my husband's asset.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah,
how long have you been married?
Oh, close to 50.
Well, I think then it's a good bet that you ought to consider it your own.
Yeah, I see. So, okay.
All right. Very good. Well, there we will leave it with the promise that, again, in another month, Dave will come back and we'll do it again. David Sinnoh is a clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at U of I, and once a month on a Friday stops by here, and we do these shows to try to help you out with money management decisions. Obviously, we want you to think very carefully. We want you to do lots of research. We want you to get different opinions. Don't just do something because Dave says to do it, but this is one of the things that you can put in your decision-making basket, and I know he's always happy to help people out.
Thanks again. It's just been lots of fun.
Very good. We appreciate it. Focus 580, the show made possible in part with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Focus 580 is also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. We will take a break right now. Coming up in the next part of Focus 580, we will look back to the 1979 Iranian hostage crisis, and our guest will be journalist David Harris. He's got a new book out that's all about it. It's titled The Crisis, The President, The Prophet, and the Shah, 1979 and the Coming of Militant Islam. First, though, we have an update for you on the markets, so stay tuned.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is